Good morning, everyone. This is Good Medicine is Cheaper Medicine. I'm Shelley Wrench, along with Dr. Nash Gabriel.
And it's good afternoon for those who are listening to the podcast.
Or it could be good night.
Because it's Saturday or Sunday, and if you're a golfer, well, not, not this weather, but if you're a golfer, you will be on the golf course probably when this is broadcast.
Or if you have insomnia and you go to our website and listen to our podcast, it could be 3 o'clock in the morning.
Or when you're driving long distance, like 40, 50 miles, and you can listen, and we try our best to be informative and useful to the public. Okay, Shelley, what do you talk about today?
Shared decision making. A lot of people outside
patients.
Yes. A lot of people outside of the healthcare world probably have no idea what that is. Probably a lot of people inside the healthcare arena don't even know that. But our based on our practice, because we are participating in a model with CMS Medicare, which is called the oncology care model, one of the major regulations, as we've talked about in earlier episodes, is making sure that the patient actually shares in the decision making of their treatment. What say you?
What say I? You know what? What I will say is what actually patients tell me. So I see a lot of patients' second opinion, whatever it is. One of the common themes. I always ask them, I mean, why are you switching doctors? Why are you coming second opinion? They have many, many reasons. But one of the common reasons is I want a doctor who tell me what we should do, not asking me what should be done. You know, Shelley, I'm 66 years old now. And as you get older, you get kind of trapped into this zone where you always talk about your life experience, right? When you're younger, you talk about your opinions. But
well, I'm not there
older,
yet. Maybe that's why I'm not getting
I'll give you a story. I was doing my fellowship in St. Louis, Missouri. I had a rotation at the VA hospital. And at the VA, we had a meeting once a week to discuss cases. And one of the attendings, an oncologist, who actually was not an oncologist. He was a German hematologist who never trained in cancer treatment, but is a VA, and they appoint people. Sometimes they don't know what that's. That's a different story. Probably Mr. Trump should not hear this. But so we're discussing a case, and everybody's giving an opinion. We had two bright surgeons, cancer surgeons, and it was him, and I was the fellow. I was his subordinate. And, you know, what are the options for this patient? And somebody said, how about we do this? What have we do this? And I give my opinion. And my supervisor said, well, I really think we should ask the patient what he wants to do. I was livid. Although he was my supervisor, I looked at him and I said, really? We are here challenged. We are all intelligent, well-educated, trained physicians. We are struggling what to do. Now you want the patient who has no medical background and it's his own body.
And he was just diagnosed with a deadly disease.
Yes.
You think about even buying a car, let alone
that taught me a lesson. Shall that taught me a lesson that I think those of us who throw the burden of decision-making on patients, it has to be the result of either incompetence or carelessness. If you are competent, you know what, that's what I do with my patients. Hey, this is what we are dealing with. I know we have to do this, and this is what it involves. Of course, the patient will have to agree.
Well, of course. They have to know their options, right? And I, when I used to do your dictation transcription a long time ago, I could always tell by the hint in the tone of your voice, you would give options, and you would kind of, I knew which one that you wanted just by your tone of voice, and I'm sure that patients pick up on that as well. It's what it is best for the patient, but you do have to say, I mean, there might be some patients who just say, I don't want to do anything. So they do have to know their options, like frequency and what are the side effects and that kind of thing. I can understand going that far with it, but ultimately you have to be the one that says this is going to give you your best outcome and give you the best quality of life.
Yes, from my experience, the patients who get upset about the decision being thrown in their court rather than being told what they should do is usually because the patient is still not well informed about their disease. So the job of the physician is, somebody comes with, let's say, stage 4 lung cancer. My job is to eloquently state, this is stage 4 disease. It doesn't get worse short of death. That's number one. Number two, you cannot cure it. Number three, there are treatment options, including doing nothing. And number four, patients always ask, how much time do I have?
And you've got that crystal ball, right?
Yeah, with the crystal ball, you're right. And that's usually a challenging thing, because when I was staying in Scotland and in Iraq, we were told it's a mortal sin to mention the statistics to patients.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in Scotland, when I was doing my internal medicine specialty board exam, we were told, if you mention the statistics to patients, kiss it goodbye. Not only you're a flunk, you will never be allowed to take the test again.
Well, this is before there was...
I disagree.
Well, this is before there was internet. Now people can actually go out there and they can Google the statistics themselves. It's not like they have to go into the library and pull out cards and find a book.
I think you're right. I think that originated from the patriarchal attitude of the medical profession towards patients. Meaning, you the patient, you do what I say. In fact, we were even told that you shouldn't explain the details of the diagnosis and the prognosis and all that. In America, that doesn't happen. It shouldn't happen.
Not in this day and age, no.
But back to the statistics. When you tell, I mean, I have seen patients when I tell them, well, the statistics show on average patient lives 18 months. I have seen some who live 6 years. I have seen some who live 6 days. I had a patient one day. He came to me and he said, exactly 18 months ago, you told me I have 18 months to live. Today is the day. So what do you think? Am I ready to check out? No, it's statistics. I even use the bell curve. We call it the Kaplan-Meier curve of statistics.
Yes.
So my conclusion is, I think the Scots and the British were wrong. I think patients need to know statistics. Actually, they will, as you said, they will get it from the internet anyways. But our job is to explain the essence, the details of the statistics. So when we say the average American male lives 74 years, that doesn't mean everybody who's 74 should go check into the funeral home. Because we know men who have reached the age of 70, in fact, men who have reached the age of 65 have a 40% chance of reaching the age of 90. So a cancer patient, and I explain this to them, when I give you the first treatment, if you show signs of response, your probability now is shifting. That detail is important. It is time consuming. It's important. And it's important also that there is also another set of ears, a spouse, a child, a friend, so that when they go home, they can reiterate.
Right. I mean, thankfully I've never been in that situation, but I can't imagine being told I have cancer and then I have to think about everything that you're telling me. I mean, there's probably so many things that, because ultimately you're basically just, all these questions are going around in your head. I would only think of, you know, what is this going to do to me? How long am I going to live?
Hence, repeating and recounseling by the people who know what they're talking about. So we sometimes talk about a hospice nurse would go to a patient and tell them about the prognosis.
Or a chaplain.
Or a chaplain. We had stories we have mentioned in the previous programs,
yeah.
Previous episodes. That is a problem, because to me, the person who will counsel really have to have detailed knowledge of the disease, the biology of the disease, we call it the natural history of the disease, the prognosis, and most importantly, what are the treatment options. When the patient knows those four parameters, and you tell them, listen, the options are we can give you either chemotherapy, and just example, chemotherapy or immunotherapy or the two of them, the side effects are this and this. But if one of those options is superior to the others, I will not mention the others. Why would I mention an inferior treatment as an option to a patient who wants to fight?
Yeah, I get that.
But we do that. I don't. The medical profession does that. And they throw that responsibility to the patient. Okay, I decided to flip a coin and see which one takes. That's not what it is. Poor patients. Flip a coin to make a decision.
Well, even think about the guidelines out there, you know, and some of the physicians who just go according to the algorithms. Like, patient has this indication, this stage, this is their comorbidities, and this is their age, and it just spits out, this is the only option. That's even worse.
That's exactly. That's much
that's
worse.
That's dangerous to me.
And I tell you what, Shelley, I think last week we had an episode about the bureaucracy and rules and regulations and the fourth branch of the government, the bureaucracy. I think that's very relevant to what we're discussing, what we're mentioning about the guidelines. The guidelines that also are not always in the best patient's interest are part of the governors of medicine. There are a lot of agencies that believe that there should be a patriarchal society, a patriarchal system where a group of physicians will tell everybody in the U.S. how to treat patients. That is the ultimate bureaucracy. Unfortunately, many people fall for it. What that does, these committees, and many members of the committees are actually infested with interest from drug companies. And they design a guideline, and they are put on the internet, and you go, and as you said, you plug the name, the age of the patient, whatever, and tell you, oh, this is the best for the patient.
You don't need physicians anymore, right? You just need a monkey to be able to put in that data and spits out the answer.
To be honest with you, Shelley, that's the intent.
Think about that.
That's the intent.
I didn't think about this, but with the shared decision-making being so prevalent through this program that we're doing for Medicare, it goes completely against the grain of what's happening in the commercial payers. The commercial payers are the ones that have their own payer pathways. They make the decision for you and the patient.
Yes.
So it's completely against what Medicare is trying to do.
So when I make a decision to treat a patient,
how many times do we have to tell you, sorry, it's not on the payer pathway?
The insurance company will say, no, we will not cover this.
But they want this.
Yes.
They want another regimen.
Yes. Well, these are the unfortunate realities. And I tell you what, Shelley, a lot of that, again, is part of what we discussed last week, which was the bureaucracy. When the medical establishment...
Bureaucracy or...
Bureaucracy.
Yeah, or politics. I mean, there's a whole lot of politics.
Bureaucracy is the ultimate politics.
Yeah, yeah.
When we as a society decided that we will standardize how we treat patients, you know how much I hate that word standardize? How can we standardize caring for 320 million different individuals with different mindset, with different diseases, with different physiology and different biology? How
genetics.
Can we,
different
and different genetics. Genetics, how dare we standardize and make it like rubber stamp, cookbook, and everybody has to follow? Because now even lawyers have learned that you follow the standard of care. Who set the standard of care? Bunch of guys and gals. Who are they? There is now writings by real, intelligent, independent physicians who are saying we're gone too far with putting these bureaucratic guidelines that the insurance companies are jumping into them. Because now when you say, insurance companies say, no, we'll not cover this. Basically, a lady have a breast cancer, and the guideline will say she needs to get the drug A, B, C. Drug A can cause heart damage. So I see a patient, she has heart failure. Really? I give her drug A, forget it. No, go to hell, I will not do that. But the payer will say, insurance will say, but that's according to the guideline. So what do you say?
And what guidelines do you say? Yeah, but they won't even give us an authorization.
I know.
So if there's no authorization, there's no payment, and the patient's all hung out to dry.
This again goes back to the last week thing. But we give it enough time. But the role of the bureaucracy and how much it's affecting us, how we treat patients, and our relationship with our patients. Going back to the shared decision making, we sit down with patients, and I tell them this is what we need to do. It can be a little bit of a problem when we hear next day the insurance say, no, we will not cover for this. That's a problem. Now, it gets worse when you tell the patients, I have no idea what I'm doing. I want you to decide how to treat you. And that's what the part of the shared decision making is.
Do they still have, physicians, do you guys still have those roundtable discussions on how to treat patients? And how does that play into this really, the patients sharing of their decision making?
Oh, you're talking about tumor boards?
Yes.
Well, the tumor boards were designed by the American College of Surgeons, where it was required for every hospital who provide cancer services to have a tumor board where every once a week, physicians of all specialties, nurses, will sit down and discuss cases as an educational event.
Okay, so only educational, not to determine.
Yes,
okay.
Unfortunately, now it has degenerated into a real decision-making process. And that's why I don't go to those meetings, because how do you expect 15 docs who have not seen a patient to make a decision on how to treat the patient?
Or even come together and have the same common decision.
Number two, how dare you have 15 docs, some of them are not cancer specialists, actually have a vote or a voice in what to do? How do we do that? How did we degenerate into that? I see patients all the time telling me that. The doctor told me they're going to have a meeting next week to discuss. So now we have the cookbook, and we have the committee to decide on how to treat. Let me tell you something. One of the best authors I've admired is Gustave Le Bon. He died in 1914, 1915. Gustave Le Bon wrote a bunch of books, Psychology of the Crowd and The Crowd and the, you name it, four or five books, all philosophical books about the French Revolution, the American Revolution, and one of the things he mentioned about the crowd, he said, he was not promoting dictatorship, but he was saying, when you have a committee of five people, sit down, discuss an issue or a problem or a challenge, the collective decision that they make, the total IQ of the five is lower than the IQ of any of the five.
Really?
Of course it is. Of course it is. So, in fact, patients know this. Even the patients who have no high school degree. When I see them, they say, so now I'm seeing a surgeon, I'm seeing you, I'm seeing gynecology, I'm seeing this. But in this fight with the cancer, who's the captain? Patients actually ask for a captain. Yet, when we look now, the committee meetings and the tumor board meetings to decide on poor patients, oh, we have to have a meeting for a bunch of guys. You know what? If you as a physician cannot actually make a decision on a patient, send them to somebody else who can, rather than get a bunch of guys and girls, some of them not even qualified, to all have a vote. It gets more complicated. These tumor boards, we get all the specialists sitting together, and we all refer to each other. We depend, business-wise, we depend on each other.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Can you believe it?
I know.
That's
where you're
why
going.
I could go there, because you don't dare disagree with the surgeon who sends you patients. You disagree with him or her in the front of everybody else. You will say, kiss it goodbye. And believe it or not, it happened to me more than once, more than twice, more than three times. And I got sick and tired of it because, you know, again, it all goes back to one thing. Of course, you do the right thing. Number two is the freedom of the tongue. I left Iraq because I only wanted one thing. I want to see, to say what I want to say. I wasn't allowed to do that in Iraq, but here I can.
Yeah, yeah.
And now to go in the United States to sit in a meeting that's supposed to help education and patient care and be scared to say something that might offend others.
Well, don't you think that the surgeon would probably want to make sure that part of the treatment plan is surgery? And don't you think that
that's
the
okay,
radiation specialist would want? I mean, does that interfere with their true decision, their
Charlie,
true
Charlie,
judgment?
Not to be critical of my colleagues. I have seen.
I'm not trying to be critical, but don't you think?
I have seen medical oncologists, cancer doctors like me, decide to give a treatment that was not the best for the patient, in my opinion, because the surgeon told them so. Oh, I cannot upset the surgeon. That's a problem. But anyway, that's for us. That's distraction from. Shared, was that what do you call it?
Shared decision making.
Shared decision making. And now the government is.
Yeah, they made it a thing. So now that now they want to measure and make sure that we actually have to document and prove that we gave the plan of therapy to the patient and that they had shared decision making marked on that document.
Well, giving the patient the plan and tell them exactly what you were doing is critical. You have to. Patients have to know exactly what we're giving them, what do we expect, what side effects, potential benefit, potential harm, alternative treatments if they don't agree with that. If they say, I don't want to deal with those side effects, then you will give them option two or option
right.
three or option four, which is do nothing. That is critical and important. My concern is to have actually the patients make a decision when they are not physicians. In fact, even the physician should not treat herself or himself. I mean,
I agree.
It's part of the profession that we should not treat ourselves. And yet, we're moving in a direction that patients will have to make those decisions. That's a lot of burden on people who actually don't have the knowledge or the training. But you just see it. Why are the regulators moving in that direction? Why is Medicare asking us to do this?
I really don't know.
I think I do.
What do you think?
I think it's all extension of Obamacare. Find ways to deny treatment to patients. You know, throwing Aunt Annie from the cliff, whatever it was.
Granny
from the cliff. There are a lot of people who during that era where they thought we were wasting a lot of money on caring for the sick. And I think what the intention, this is all cryptic hidden in my opinion, this might be conspiracy theory, is if you explain everything to the patients that you might scare some of them of getting treatment and go home and decide to die, that will be saving few hundred thousand dollars or few thousand dollars to the system. Remember, Shelley, when we do clinical trials also, we have what we call the consent form where patients sign paper about what to expect from the experiment. It's important. But when you look at it, patients are getting nowadays get disgusted. 30 pages. Anything that we suspect that can happen, we have to write down. Anything that happened to the mice and rats when we experiment with the drug before we take it to humans have to be written there. That's, again, another bureaucracy by itself because it's self-defeating. In the old days, when I started doing research 20 years ago, those were usually 3 pages. Now they are average 29 pages. Tell me,
wow.
A cancer patient fighting for their lives, going for a clinical trial, usually after one or two prior treatments, to read 29 pages of verbiage that a PhD can hardly comprehend. Sometimes I can't understand it. I even email people, what did you mean by this line, by that line? It's all part of the trying to inform the patients. Sometimes, a lot of times, that actually is damaging and hurtful to the patients.
Yeah, and another part of the oncology care model of part of the shared decision-making is making sure that they understand what the total cost of care is for the time that they're being looked at. The data is being obtained for that period of time. It's a 6-month period that they're on this model, right?
Okay, Shelley, what do you think about transparency in the cost of care?
Well, number one, everybody knows the cost of cancer care is high. Number two, when we talk to cancer patients about their finances, it's typically we only talk to them when they're going to have like copay out of pocket that they have to worry about. Then we have that conversation. But if you have a patient comes in with Medicare and AARP or Anthem as a secondary, and their total cost of care for the entire year is $135, right? Why have them worry about finances or seeing the total cost of care when that's not even an issue? They've planned ahead and have that out-of-pocket already taken care of. Now we're forced for 6 months to estimate what we think that the total cost of care is going to be for 6 months. So you have any chemotherapy, you know, they're a couple of $1,000s at least, except for the generics.
You know, Shelley, I am not in love with the government. You know that, right?
I think everybody knows that.
But I really have some reasons to believe that transparency of cost might be useful.
No, I'm not saying that. I think that we should be transparent at one point, but not when they just triggered, they're starting their first chemotherapy. Before we can put that IV in their arm, they're going to see a big, huge amount of money in front of them. How many times when I go out and I show them this, they back off. Like, oh, I don't think I want to do this, even though they have nothing out of their pocket.
Yes, but when you drive by our friend Doug Wakeham's car dealership, every single car
has
a sticker on it with a huge, how much the cost of the... Now, medicine is a commodity. Why aren't we transparent? I mean, you and I know. The same treatment given to a same patient in two different institutions, same treatment, exactly identical, the cost can be three, four-fold difference.
At least, yeah.
Shouldn't the patients know that? Especially when we know there is all the evidence now. The more expensive an institution is, the lower is the quality of care.
Hence the reason for this show, Good Medicine is Cheaper Medicine, and the reason you wrote the book. Well, people can listen to this podcast along with all of our other podcasts on GabrielCancerCenter.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Shelley. It was another exciting thing, and we have to figure out another topic for next episode, but I like to expand on the transparency and the cost, because I really think, contrary to what you think, I disagree with you, I think it can be useful. Thank you all.
Thank you.